Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. The condition known as autism was not even defined in medicine until 1943. Since then, its prevalence increased steadily through the years until the 1990s, when the numbers suddenly shot up. Today, roughly one out of every 88 children born in the United States is diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder. While that might sound like bleak news, Temple Grandin says there is a flip side. Grandin is one of the best-known and accomplished people with autism today. In her new book, The Autistic Brain, Grandin writes that there is a revolution underway in how we view and work with autism. Temple Grandin joins us on the line now. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Great to be here.
You were diagnosed with autism not all that long after autism was first defined. Obviously, there were some very wrong theories about autism that have been made and discarded since then. But how much would you say, how much more confident is science today in understanding the nature of autism than it was 20, 30, 50 years ago?
They know now that it's definitely a neurological disorder. It's not psychological. No, but the problem is the diagnosis has changed over the years. And in my book, The Autistic Brain, Richard Panik and I go over the whole history of the diagnosis. Every decade or so, they changed some of the requirements. It's a behavioral profile of a certain cluster of symptoms, not a precise diagnosis, you know, like tuberculosis would be.
Well, and it was fascinating to see that one of the reasons that some people were diagnosed while others weren't was because of a simple typographical error in the manual.
Well, that's right. You see, and see, the DSM is probably half science, and the other half of it is doctors' opinions sitting around conference room tables.
You write in several places in this latest book about your enthusiasm for taking advantage of imaging studies on your own brain.
Yeah.
Why are you so keen to see inside your brain?
Well, I sort of like the, you know, it's been very interesting for me, first of all, learning that my thinking was different. You know, when I was young, I thought everybody was a visual thinker like me. I didn't know I was different until I started interviewing people about how they think. Well, then when I found out that my thinking was different, then, of course, you know, scientists get interested in what's going on inside. You might say exploring, basically.
Well, and it is a fascinating opportunity. How would you compare the usefulness of the imaging technology that's available and employed by scientists today versus the MRI you first underwent in 1987?
Oh, there's been huge, huge advances in the technology compared to the one in 1987. Just huge. Those images done by Walter Snyder at the University of Pittsburgh on the high-definition diffuse intensure imaging can track white fiber bundles that connect up different departments in the brain. Basically, dissect out all the white matter interconnector circuits. And this technology was originally paid for by the Defense Department for head injuries. It has amazing potential for diagnosing autism and many other different things. But it's going to take a lot of subjects put through the scanner in order to do what's called norming the test. At what point is one of those fiber bundles abnormal?
Right, and I think you write one of the key challenges is that what is the case in one autistic brain is not necessarily the case in another autistic brain.
Now, the thing that seems to be the most universal, at least on the highly verbal people with autism, are the circuits for social face recognition circuits and circuits for recognizing facial expressions. That seems to be pretty universal in all the people that have good speech. The other stuff, like visual thinking and mathematical thinking, and you know, size of the cerebellum, the size of the fear center, like my fear center is bigger than normal, but I want to emphasize that's not on everybody. You see, all those other things are very variable.
Well, what would you think the greatest promise is for the use of these studies? It's one thing to be able to see what's going on and look at what, as you say, a broken brain actually looks like.
Well, it isn't broken because, okay, in a head injury, you rip fiber bundles. In a developmental difference, they just grow in a different way. Okay, for example, there's different types of language problems. I had problems with getting my speech out. And the brain scans show that there were problems with the amount of bandwidth I had on the speak-what-you-see circuit. But then another kind of kid, he yaks out all these TV commercials and movie scripts, but he doesn't know what the words mean. You see, that's a different type of a problem. You see, and ultimately, some of those things could be diagnosed when the child's still nonverbal and you change the way you do therapy for a kid that's echolalic and yaks out TV commercials compared to a kid like me that can't get the speech out.
Would this also have implications for the idea that you write about playing to an autistic person's strengths down the road?
Well, you definitely want to play to their strengths. And my strength was art. Strengths often show up around 8 or 9 years old, sometimes earlier, but usually, you know, third grade or so, 8 years old. That's when my ability in art really showed up. You know, that's when ability in math will oftentimes really show up. Build on the kid's area of strength. We got way too much emphasis on deficits. You know, kids that are super good at math often have troubles with reading. You know, and obviously we got to work on reading. If we've got a third grader that's super good at math, I don't want him getting bored with baby math and becoming a behavior problem. No, if that third grader can do a sixth grade math book, then let him have the sixth grade math book. Let him have the college math book if he can do it.
Right. I think you write about your own experience in high school with a particularly remarkable teacher, but the one area that you said did not work out so well was his insistence that you have to get down algebra before you got
that
anything else.
That's a mistake. In fact, what I'm finding now and talking to lots of people is that there's individuals who cannot do algebra that should go right to geometry and right straight to trigonometry. And in my book, The Autistic Brain, I also present the scientific research that shows that the picture thinker like me and the more mathematical thinker actually are two different types of visual spatial thinking. And I've got both brain scan research and research with various paper and pencil tests that prove that these two types of thinking actually do exist. And all those references are in the book.
One of the most interesting sections, I thought, in this book revolves around the idea of sensory problems among people with autism. And first, how do you describe your own sensory problems?
Well, I have problems with touch sensitivity, with scratchy clothes. I had a lot of problems with loud noise. Then you have other individuals that can't stand fluorescent lights because they can see the flicker of fluorescent lights. And in the autistic brain, I go through the different types of sensory problems. I also have some tips on ways to adjust to those problems. But of one area I think there needs to be a lot of research on is the sensory problems, because they can range from being a nuisance to being extremely debilitating. And there are some individuals that will never be able to tolerate a noisy restaurant.
Well, and scientists have known that these sensory problems existed for a while, but why do you think they have been so under-researched or understudied?
Well, I think part of the problem is they are so variable. If you take 10 kids labeled autistic, maybe only three of them really have a bad problem with the fluorescent lights. You know, maybe there's one or two that have a problem with certain smells, but the rest don't. The sensory issues tend to be extremely variable, you know, where things like problems with the face recognition circuits, some of the social circuits, at least in the kids that are verbal, that tends to be pretty much even across the spectrum.
Well, what do you think the strategy ought to be in looking at sensory problems?
Well, you have to figure out what sensory problem the kid has and then try to do something about it. Now, when it comes to sound sensitivity, sometimes a kid can be desensitized if he initiates the sound. All right, let's take the dreaded smoke alarm. Let's take a smoke alarm, wrap it up in five towels. Then he reaches in there and turns it on, where he initiates it. Then you gradually make it louder by taking towels off of it. But when the child controls the initiation of the dreaded sound, it's easier to desensitize.
As you say, I imagine one of the issues is that there is so much variability. You know, when science, when researchers deal with people with headaches, they can say, take a Tylenol or,
That's right.
But there are so many variables from one autistic person to another, it's difficult to come up with
a
blanket.
What needs to be done in terms of researching the sensory problems, and I discuss that in the autistic brain, is we're going to have to research it by the type of sensory problem a person has, because you can get these sensory problems with dyslexia, with ADHD, learning difficulties, tons of different labels, and say, okay, we'll take the people that have a problem with fluorescent lights, and we put them all together as one group, and then we have controls that don't have that problem. And you've got to study them based on what their sensory problem is.
In this book, you write about the mild Asperger types, the people who used to go through life as simply shy or geeky. Are there advantages to having the autism spectrum label, or can it be inhibiting?
I get worried with some of these smart kids with them getting held back, because you go out to Silicon Valley, I mean, half the people there are a little bit on the spectrum, and they avoid the labels like the plague. But in order to get services, you got to have the label. And the kids on the real mild end tend to get it because they don't have friends. They're having social problems in school. And one thing I would strongly recommend is get kids involved with shared interests. You know, if they like horses, how about ride horses? If they like electronics, they could get in a hackerspace electronics club, or be in band, or be in art classes, or cooking classes, or 4-H, or FFA, or Boy Scouts. Get them involved with things where they have a shared interest. And then often the teasing does not happen in those shared interest activities.
Well, what are the other ways that you recommend schools and parents better assist children across the autistic spectrum in preparing them to succeed after they are children?
Well, first of all, autism is a very big spectrum. I mean, at one end of it, you've got Einstein, who had no language until age 3. And at the other end, you've got somebody that remains nonverbal and is going to have to live in a supervised living situation. And the problem is they're all called autism. And I think it's oftentimes hard for teachers to shift gears between, you know, a kid that, you know, ought to be trained to be a scientist versus a kid that will have to live in a group home. You know, it's a very, very big spectrum.
Absolutely. Would you contend, though, that in the idea of identifying strengths, that regardless of where you are on that spectrum, there are strengths to be taken advantage of?
Usually there are strengths. You know, because you have a big moderate range where they're partially verbal, and some of those can be very good at, you know, doing jobs in an office, like, you know, running a photocopier, running the shredder, or doing some filing.
I know you are loath to predict how autism will be viewed and treated in, say, the next 60 years, but I am curious if you think science has as far to go in the next 60 years as it has since you were first diagnosed.
Well, I think in the next 10 years or so, they're going to start doing everything with brain scans. But the problem is you're going to have to norm the test. Okay, if you look at in the autistic brain book, I've got my scan for the look what you see circuit, and then we've got the scan for the normal one. Now, how many bushes does it have to have before it gets abnormal? Well, you're going to have to scan a pile of people that have been very, very clinically evaluated very carefully for language problems in order to determine when a circuit has enough bushes to become abnormal. You see, because a lot of these things are continuous. But
sure.
My speak what you see circuit, you look at the one that's in the USA Today, that's you know, that's really abnormal. It goes all over the whole brain, where the normal speak what you see circuit stops at the language areas.
Are you optimistic about where we are today and where we are likely to go?
Well, one thing I get worried about is I see too many kids getting locked into the labels. Kids come up to me and they want to tell me all about their autism. I'd rather hear about their science project or hear that they like to train dogs or they like history, you know, or they like astronomy, you know, whatever their favorite thing is.
You think kids are too eager to keep the label on themselves?
Well, they're too eager to get all, you see, autistic kids tend to get fixated on their favorite stuff. And they get way too fixated on, oh, they want to tell me all about their autism. Well, I don't really want to talk to a 22-year-old that's fully verbal about his autism. I'd rather talk about how do we get him a job that he can do that he's going to like. We need to be teaching these kids work skills, and I think that needs to start in middle school. You know, if there's a paper route around, that's great, but I know those are gone. But how about walking some dogs for some people? Or maybe buying groceries for, you know, an old lady, and every, you know, twice a week you got to buy her groceries, get her to list and buy her groceries for her. You know, there's a discipline to work that kids need to learn.
Well, yours is a remarkable story, and the book is remarkable as well. And Temple Grandin, I thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Well, it's great to be here, and I hope you all read The Autistic Brain.
Temple Grandin is a professor of animal science at Colorado State University. She also lives with an autism spectrum disorder and has written several best-selling books on the subject. Her new book, written with Richard Panik, is called The Autistic Brain, Thinking Across the Spectrum. There's a link to more about it from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. Another revolution in imaging may soon be underway. We'll hear about its Milwaukee connection after a break on WUWM.